session number 11939, row 16.
Mr. J.L. Williams, Reel 16. On what date did you reach this battalion, Mr. Williams?
I suspect it was somewhere around about Christmas Day, by the time we got wandered through these various places, because I think I remember the men telling me that they'd had some pork and it was swimming in the half mess tins. Or we had pork when we just arrived, but I'm not quite sure. But it was the 6th Battalion of the Aeromat Infantry, 6th Battalion of the Royal West Kent Regiment, another territorial battalion of the Royal West Kent Regiment. And it was at a state-owned place very near the town of Mateur, which we'd attempted to take and failed, or they'd attempted. And we were in front of two big mountains, one which was called Jebel El Azag, another on the other side of the road was Jebel El Azred. One was covered with scrub and the other one was stony. And they're better known as Green and Bald Hill. That's how we refer to them, Green and Bald Hill. And the road went through there and we were stopped there. I was very lucky, and that when we went into the CO's dugout when we arrived, it was dark. We had a lamp lit there. And I said, sir, I've been trained in small arms, but particularly on a 3-inch mortar. I love the 3-inch mortar. And could you bear it in mind whenever there's a vacancy, if you haven't got... Oh, God, old boy, he said, our mortar officer was killed just 2 days ago. He said, you've just arrived on time. Asked me one or two questions, said, right, well, you're in charge. Well, I could have whistled and sung. It was pouring with rain, but I was so happy.
Who was the commanding officer of the battalion?
Henry Lovell. A regular officer, he was right getting on in years. A tall man, walked with a slight sort of shake and so on. Not shake, but his legs were slightly bowed a bit. And he was a rather well-to-do merchant family. There was a firm called Lovell and Christmas, which was an Argentine London firm, quite well off, provisions and things like that. And he was the Lovell side of it, Henry. Very nice.
But there, you immediately made mortar officer.
Yes.
What was your baptism to fire then?
Well, before that was very soon, but before that I should tell you, I was taken round and went next morning, and the mortars were in position on this hillside, and it was still raining. It did stop later on in Tunisia, but it was raining. And I said to the guys, well, I'm your new officer now, I'll get to know you all later. And I got the response from Cockneys and lads from Kent. Okay, sir, we'll get to know you. It's a bit damp, isn't it? Yes, sir, we'll keep your head down, I said. And I walked round and there was one chap bailing out a slit trench with a McConaughey tin because it's so full of water. And I said, it's a little bit wet down there, soldier, isn't it? He called me and said, I wish it was a pint and I was something to do in Gateshead High Street. I said, I think you and I come somewhere from the same district. And I should mention, although this was mainly natives of Kent, Maidstone area and South London, before the war, an awful lot of Geordies went south looking for work. And there was a fair sprinkling of Geordies throughout this battalion as well, because they'd been called up in their age group and put in the nearest battalion. And then the next day, and I should tell you, opposite us were paratroops, German paratroops. And they were led by a very famous leader called Major Witzig, W-I-T-Z-I-G. Now, when he was lieutenant in 1940, he was the one, you remember the great concrete forts at Ibn Emil? Well, he led the parachuting party which dropped on top of those forts and captured them. So he was very famous. We hadn't been there 3 days when I got slightly in the wrong with old Lovell, because another officer and I, we thought, you know, these things, these field cards, which said, I am quite well, I hope to see you soon. I have not received a letter from you for some time, so. And I said, we filled one of these in, have not seen you, I hope to see you soon, and decided Major Witzig and put it in the box for the CO. And he had his head. He said, "Are you the bloody fools I've been playing?" That's it. Yes, he said, "What the hell are you doing? What are you playing?" I said, "Well, it seemed rather funny at the time, sir." He said, "Well, I don't think it is bloody funny. Don't do it again." I said, "Right, sir, we won't." We went down. I said, "This book, we were lucky to get away there." And then that morning, suddenly, they put in a strong patrol attack. And the major second in command called me, and I rushed up and I fired my first mortars in action into a defile where the Germans were. And that was my first taste. There was a bit of shelling, and sadly, one of the officers who'd come up with us, who was a Royal West Kent officer, was killed. A little story attached to him was he was a New Zealander, and he'd been very, very badly treated by this officer in the 7th Battalion, principally because he was a colonial, you know. And he told me he had a big sheep farm in his family.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, and wait a minute, I'll tell you in a minute. I'll come to it in a minute. And he said to me, because as I say, I was a little bit older, what old would I be? But, well, in 1942, I was 29. And he said, "Do you know, Jack, I'm sure I could be a good officer." I said, "Of course you can be a good officer. You've just let yourself be talked down by this bloody awful man. You're as good an officer as anybody here." He said, "Well, I'm going to do my duty. I want to show people that I can do it." He said, "There's only one thing. Will you make sure that if I buy it, if I get killed, that I'm buried according to the rites of the Church of England?" And I said, "Okay, old boy." He was killed the third day. His men were in Sutrans, and he was running around rather unguardedly, looking to see if they were all right. The shell landed and killed him. And the colonel called me and he said, will you see about him buried?" And I took and buried him in a place. You know, the army rule is you bury somebody near a marked track or near a road where the bodies can be recovered and reinterred, you know, and where you can give a map reference. And they buried him, and the padre wasn't there. So I read the shortened version of the service, buried service, from the back of my field service pocketbook. And I said to the sergeant charge, "Now remember, if anything happens to me, this officer had a particular request that he should be buried by the Church of England padre." "Where is it?" "Oh, he stays down at the... he stays down. He only comes up with the rations, and he doesn't stay very long, comes up in the dark." And I said, "Right, now wait." And he came up. I said, "Okay, partner, I want to work with you." He said, "Well, look, old boy, I've got to get back." I said, "Not before you've done this job." I said, "There's one of your flock who had a particular request." He said, "No other time." I took him by the arm, led him away around, and in a trembling voice, he read the burial service over this grave and buggered off as quickly as he could. That made me feel very anti-religious.
Did you recall who he was?
No. But we had two padres. We had this Church of England padre, and we had a Roman Catholic padre. Now, we used to talk among ourselves and say, "Why is this Roman Catholic padre so brave?" Because later on, there'd be a bloke lying on the ground, and he'd be kneeling down with bullets whizzing in all directions, giving him last rites and absolution and all that sort of thing. We thought, well, maybe it's because they're not married and they've got a fixed job, so they don't care what happens to them. They're sure they're going to go to heaven. But this Church of England padre...
Can you describe the rest of your action in front of these two hills?
No, well, I just fired the mortar into this gap a little between the two hills. And at the finish, I saw some slight movement. I wasn't sure what I was engaging, but I was preventing anybody coming through, you see. There was a bit of artillery fire coming over the top. We had to sort of keep in our slit trenches or duck down and so on, because I was OPing these mortars a little bit ahead because it was the first time I'd been in action. And I was just lying on some bare rocks. But I didn't have any particular feelings. I was so pleased I was able to use my mortars. You probably think I've got a bit of fixation about mortars, but the idea that I was using them against the enemy filled me with an elation which overcame all other sorts of things, you know. And it was a very short duration. And then the enemy retired and the shelling stopped, and we went back to our normal. Now, this must have been somewhere in the last two or three days of 1942, you know. It was very drab countryside at that time. The road disappeared between these two hills. Very much like a road on the Durham Moors, you know.
Were the Germans up on the hills?
They were up on the hills, yes. And we were in the shallow part, but they had to come down to get at us and so we could get at them. But we were in a disadvantageous position. There wasn't much movement by us during daylight hours, you know, except from behind cover. You know, there were ravines and so on, but it was... But I was surprised later on when I looked at it, at the inactivity of the Germans, whether they were short of ammunition and so on, but there they were. And they were paratroops, you know, and they were good soldiers. And Major Witzig was, of course, a very famous German soldier, paratroop leader. He became colonel later on in the Tunisian campaign. We bumped into some of his men later. But it was very surprising.
Where did you move after this?
Well, from there, we were suddenly called down to a place called Rabah, R-O-B-A-A. It was just south of the Majerda line, you know, Middle Tunisia, I'll call it for a want of it. And we went into the line there. And there was an attack taking place. And we took this place, and Germans pushed back, and then they were massing for an attack. And suddenly I found attached to me a platoon of Americans with a young officer in charge. And he was on the blower to his company commander and so on. And I said, "We've got to get your men in slip train, get them dug in, you know." And he said, "Yeah, they're digging in." And the first thing I did when I got there, there was a nice bit of ground in front, which you always range on a bit of killing ground. You might range on it there, or you might range over here and then move yourself, so the enemy didn't know where you. And there was a lovely bit of killing ground about 800 yards away. So I ranged on it and I put him down. And this Yankee officer was in a hell of a state. And his men, you know, there was a bit of shelling going on, and the sort of things were, "These goddamn shells are throwing rocks on us, sir." And "Sarge, what are, you know," and very, very, a lot of cleft. Our blokes were just lying there, smoking and just waiting. And then the Germans start moving towards us. And this officer said, "There's a Krauts coming now. Open fire on them, will you?" And I said, "No, just you wait. I'll fire on them when we get them to a position where I want them." And he got on the blower and said, "The Germans are advancing, and this goddamn limey officer won't open fire." So I kicked him in the backside. I said, "British officer." He said, "This British officer won't fire." And I told him, I said, wait, and we'll get them where we want them." And they'll come in. And suddenly they all up sticks and went out. The officer leading them. And the sergeant, the young...
They went off.
They did a bunk.
Uh-huh.
It was so... They'd left the slip trench and they'd all had their fags and their sweets and so on. So, and our blokes went in the slip trench and filled their pockets and came. And we still had time to kill the Germans, or shoot the Germans up. And I always remember there was a sergeant, he was the last man there. He obviously would want to say, "Come on, sergeant, American soldiers can do better than this." And he said, "Come on, fellas, you can't do this to me." And they were disappearing down this bit of track that they went and got the hell out of them. And we had to just wait till the Germans got my bit of killing ground and killed them.
Were they relatively green, these men?
They must have been green. They eventually came back up again, rather shamefacedly. And our folks were, you know, they used to have a joke there. They used to say, "Where's this goddamn shooting gallery?" You know, the Germans, the Americans. And when anybody shot at them, they used to go away. That wasn't quite true. There were some good soldiers among. But this lot were pretty bad. But I do remember that night, they came back up in the position again. And in those days, we used to have what was called a composite ration, compo, we used to call it. It had 14 identical rations, which meant if you were one man and you got a box of 14, you had the same food for 14 days. But normally, you split it up among your people. And there were A, B, C, and D types. A type had steak and tins of steak and kidney pie. But everyone, whatever the ration was, sometimes it was sort of hash stuff. You got 7 cigarettes, and I think it was 5 or 6 boiled sweets per man as well, per day. It was pretty good. But the Yanks had that, but they also got a hot meal brought up at night, and a hot meal brought up just before dawn. And then they had the rest, whereas we were living on the ration. And I remember when the cook, big fat cook sergeant, brought these containers of food up, and my batman said, give us half your mess, then, so I'll go across and see if I can get some rum, see if I can scrounge something. And he went across to this yank and he said, anything spare there? And Bluff said, yeah, come on, fellas. He gave him some. And he said, can my officer have a bit? He said, yeah, where's it? Good. He gave him a bit. So I went across later one evening. I said, thanks very much indeed, sir. And oh, he said, that's all right, sir. He said, it's these goddamned Arabs that I'm worried about. And I said, well, the Arabs here, they're very docile agricultural people. They're not engaged in the war. They won't do any harm. He said, the bloody Arabs down there. And he said, come, you don't know where they are. And I said, well, I'll tell you where. They'd be with their heads wrapped in their bits of shattered old, clapped out old blankets hidden in a hole in the ground so they won't get shot at. You've got nothing to worry about Arabs, you know, son. Oh, I see. And he said, wait a minute. Have all your guys got some grub and some of our lads that hadn't? And he made it. He went a trip down in his wagon, way down, got some more grub and brought them up for our blokes. So there was the kind-hearted American. So I saw the two ends of that the same night. But they had this good grub. And then the Germans counterattacked a bit further down, and that was where I had one of my rare shoots. They came down in a narrowing valley. And as they got the narrow part, they were pretty well like an 1871 Bismarck. And I massacred them. I really shot them up. And when they tried to go, I was using three mortars to hit them with, and I had two just ready. As soon as I saw someone turn to, they were about a couple of hundred yards bigger in, so they ran into the mortar and again. Well, I had quite a...
Where was this, do you this call the name?
Robar. Still in Robar, yes, but it's got, it was very broken sort of country. And I had one or two new men come, some had gone sick and I got some new men. So I took them along, the Germans retreated. Some people said they thought they were Austrians, but as far as we're concerned, they were Panzergrenadiers. And I took some of my blokes along to show them the effect of the fire. And as I say, I think I counted 50 corpses in one place, and I don't think any of them had a wound above their navel. They were really glad. I brought to show my lads how effective they were. And then we moved sideways and moved further south, just past Rabah, and we were suddenly attached, found ourselves attached to the Corps d'Afrique, French. Our brigadier was absolutely livid. Our brigadier was Swifty Howlett.
Swifty?
Howlett, H-O-W-L-E-T-T. Very nice bloke. Called Swifty because he'd once been a fast bowler for Kent's second team. You always used to say, remember about that, you know.
Can I just ask you here, which brigade you were with, and which division?
Yes, I was with 78th Division, which was the Yellow Battle Axe Division. We wore Yellow Battle Axe, was here. And I was with 36th Brigade. That consisted of the 6th Royal West Kents, the 5th Buffs, and the 8th Argyll and Sutherland Highlands. Quite a mixture. And for a while, we were suddenly attached to the French Corps d'Afrique.
About what time would this be? What day?
This would be in January. In January, yes. Perhaps a little later.
When you say you were attached to them, in what role were you attached to them?
We were attached, placed under command, you might say, you know, which Swifty Howlett didn't like one little bit. He was playing absolute hell. And I was with some tirailleurs algériens. That's technically Algerian sharpshooters. They were sort of light infantry. Very nice soldiers. The officers, I suspect, they were very, very anti-British. And but these the first lot, as I say, these we were just in a covering sort of situation with these tirailleurs algériens, and they were nice souls, you know. I liked them, very disciplined. I remember the sergeant said, I've got a young French officer, sir, he's not very experienced and he's suffering from hardships. He said, I know you wouldn't ask your friend, but if you had a little bit of toilet soap. Oh, I said, yes, thank you. Yeah, I said, well, don't tell the officer I gave you. You just say you picked it up from someone. And he told me, he said, oh, he was absolutely delighted with that. So, and he was thinking of his young French officer, you know, like any other soldier would. And whilst I was there, we were these. I went across to one of my, we were in a bit of a wood. My bloke sitting around a fire. and there was a Moroccan soldier with him. And Marblock said, "It's bloody funny. Some of these officers can always smell when there's a cup of char going." I said, "Now, shut up, Sergeant. Let me get the tea poured out. Give me a drop." He said, "Come on, and you'll have to fight for it." And we were locking on, you know. And this bloody... When I looked around, here was this poor Moroccan soldier standing to attention. That's it. Sit down. Don't worry. And he said, in French, he said, "I do not understand, sir." I said, "Well..." He said, our officer only speaks to us when he wishes to give an order." I said, "Well, we have different ways of going on in the British Army. You sit down there." I gave him a fag. And he cut all our hair, incidentally, that night. And he was a law student from Fez in Morocco. And he did me a good turn, because we suddenly found that moving up among the Algerian Tirea, there were some of these Moroccan goumiers who were notorious sort of scroungers, and they'd cut your throat for tuppence. I was in my pup tent, and there was a terrible squall outside, and I rolled out under the flap with my revolver in my hand, and there was one of the French goumiers on the ground, and this Moroccan soldier had his bin about that far into his shoulder. He told me, he said, he was creeping in with a knife to try and steal something, you know, sir. So I called him over, and the sergeant of the goumier came along and kicked this bloke unmercifully. And then he went and got the officer, and the French officer kicked this bloke unmercifully. And then they put him on a mule and tied his legs with rawhide, the feet underneath the mule, and belting him all the time. And I said to the officer, "What will happen to him?" He said, "La boite." He said, 28 days, la boite. I said, "What's that?" He said, "He's put in a box where he can't lie down properly and he can't sit up." So that'll teach him to act in a proper fashion. Which friend said. Anyhow, a bit later after that, I was suddenly called and I was asked to do a patrol with a goumier. We were going to spend 2 days behind the German lines. And I went out at night and I left my mortar just inside my carriers just inside our land, because we were still using carriers at that stage. And we did a long carry into the enemy line. And I laid my fellows up, and I went to this crossroad where I was arranged to meet the goumier with their officer. And it was one which our artillery had been shelling it. And actually, I'd been firing long-range machine gun fire, because they were Vickers machine guns on the thing. You know, quite a few dead bodies ran. I thought, well, I can't. If I stand up here, I'll stand up like a sore finger. And if there's any burial party comes out, I'm not going to get a chance to slide away if I'm standing up. So I laid down among the dead men, which I thought was the safest way. I remember I was lying like that, looking up, and there was a dead Italian soldier with a beard on his back, and his beard was waving in the wind. And it started to snow, literally, sleety snow. When I was lying there, and I was quite right, and I suddenly heard some horses coming from who would be the Moroccan goumier. So I got up and went away. And I thought later, if a burial party did come out there, because we moved a bit further in behind the line, they'd see dead men lying there, and then the shape in the snow of where one had got up and walked away. I hope some of them got very superstitious fear from that. But I can still see this Italian line there with his beard waving in the breeze, you know. And I joined his goumier, and the officer in charge was Lieutenant Noel, Christmas. And anything associated with Christmas among those goumiers and the officer was quite... They were the roughest sort of characters, and they used a knife. In fact, there was one, when we were there, all I was doing was, I was told where they were going to attack. And I put my mortars in position to give them support if it was necessary for them to withdraw. I never fired my mortars. And used to go in, sentries and so on, and get up behind them, and the left hand placed over the mouth, and the knife drawn through the carotid artery, and across the voice box. The man couldn't speak. They held him for a while, while he bled copiously, and he was dead within 3 minutes, and they let him lie down on the ground, went through his pockets, that was it. And I remember once saying to Lieutenant Altamont, "Does it ever worry you? It seems a very unchristian sort of activity." He said, "What do you mean, mes goumiers?" He said, "They kill a man quietly, without pain, and lay him gently down." He said, "You fire your dirty machine guns and shrapnel and give them gangrene and things like that." He said, "Who are the Christians, my men or yours?" I said, "Well, I never thought of that." And we, the last attack they did, they fired one shot. And then backed out, and I stood to, but I didn't quite use mortars because the Germans were very much afraid of these irregular troops, you know, coming in the dark without a sound. They would take their sandals off, and if there was a stone behind us, they'd pick it up on their toes and put it to one side before they moved a foot forward and got them, you know. And they wore striped burnouses and sort of, they had their hair cut short and made into a ring, you know, plaited in a ring, and then a very flat cap on top, you know. And, well, not a cap, it was a sort of turban. And they had it on mules. And they captured one German, and they'd broken his leg with the butt of a rifle. And then we had to withdraw. We were 2 days behind the lines. I did nothing at all except run around with them and eat their food. Also, in one place where we were, the Goumier said, through the French sergeant, an officer, "Tell the English officer not to speak to his men in the dark because he sounds just like a German and would like to apologise in advance if we cut his throat." And they were all sitting looking at me and I said, "Allons les enfants de la patrie," and they all burst out laughing. They got the joke and so on. I mentioned that because later on I met him again. And anyhow, we came back and they put this wounded German on a mule when we got to a reasonable safe place. And they removed the stirrup from where his leg was, so his broken leg was swinging. And their mules and horses are just like trained dogs. And they had a very enjoyable time. They'd get one of the horses to nudge this horse, and the German's leg was swinging, he was just swooning in the saddle. And I said to Lieutenant Noel, I said, "Come on, for Christ's sake." I said, "We don't torture our prisoners when we take them." I said, "If I interfere with the habits and customs of my men, I'll destroy their fighting spirit. Let them have a little bit of fun." And they played all the way with this broken leg swinging back and forward. That was it.
Was it a usual role for the Goumier to be acting behind the line?
Yes, patrolling, doing patrols behind the line and causing... I mean, if somebody woke up in the German line and suddenly found the sentries with their throats cut lying there, and if the other had another endearing habit, if they'd run into any trouble with a particular unit and they didn't like them very much, having cut their throats, they'd remove their penis and testicles and stuff them down their throat. So they'd find their men lying there with a gaping throat and with a private parts sticking out the mouth, because the play, you know, virility was such an important thing that was the greatest insult they could do to a man, was to remove his sexual organs and shove them down his throat, you know. Very endearing lot. And we got back, and then I was suddenly called up again, whether they thought that I could speak French, but to a company of the French Foreign Legion who were about to do an attack.
This was with your platoon?
With my platoon. I went up with my platoon and...
was this the same area?
Same area. It was all with this Côte d'Afrique people. And there, when I got up there, was the officer had been killed, the sergeant in charge, and all the blokes were sharpening their bayonets. The roughest looking crew I've ever seen. They were in French uniform. And I said, "Dites-moi votre mission. Qu'est-ce que vous allez attaquer? You know, what's your mission?" He said, "Nous attaquons les Boches près de Bon." I said, "Bon? Que veut dire le mot Bon? What does Bon mean?" He said, "Bon, là-bas." So I got the map and said, "Montre-moi sur la carte." Ah, I said, "Bon." He said, "Ouais, Bon." And I said, "What nationality are you, Sergeant?" He said, "This is the German company of La Légion Étrangère." They were talking about attacking the Boche and so on. He said, "Doesn't worry you about killing your own countrymen?" He said, "When you are a legionnaire, legion is your country, only at law." And they went in with the bayonets. I fired a few mortars just to make them keep their heads down. They went in and they slaughtered these Germans without any compunction whatsoever. It was a strange thing, you know, how very much like the Gurkhas, those French could turn men of any nationality. And incidentally, I discovered later that the highest percentage of Foreign Legion are Germans, and I could train them into complete servants of France. After 5 years, they got French nationality, and that was it. But that was my, and then we were pulled back again, and that was my period with them.
How did your men relate to these people? But obviously it was a brief moment. But did
Well, they'd get one or two blokes and, you know, hey, Froggy, come here, you know, and talk a little bit of pidgin French and English to them, and these blokes would sit down. They were soldiers, friendly persons, you know. I mean, I suspect it would... Well, later on we took some Germans prisoner, and they were quite... Give me a drink of water, a fag, and say, oh, all right, Jerry, you're all right now, you know, things like that. But whereas I would have killed them. I had much more bloody-minded attitude. But if this Moroccan and... The only thing we couldn't communicate with were the Goumier, Goum. G-O-U, it was a 65th, the 65th Tabor, T-A-B-O-R, that is the unit. I'm still not quite sure what it was, a Tabor des Goumier. They're Goum, G-O-U-M, and they're tribesmen from Morocco, and they're very savage, and I could never communicate with them in their language. I used to, the mules I got on better with, because I used to give them my sweets, you know, when I was with them. And they used to look at me, prick their ears up when they saw me coming in. But they considered that was a sort of imbecility of giving good sugar sweets away to mules when I could give it to them, you know. But the tirailleurs algériens, just ordinary Algerian soldiers, very nice lads. Moroccan, nice blokes. Allegiant.